Greenpeace launched its own well-funded campaign to strengthen Kyoto. In the United Kingdom, it attacked British Petroleum. In the United States, it focused its efforts on the Global Climate Coalition's most unpopular member, Exxon. From Greenpeace's Washington, D.C. office, the group's highly committed activist cadres scoured the Capitol for evidence that might discredit their oil-funded opponents. An allied group, the National Environmental Trust, dug up an API document suggesting that the Oil Industry Association had decided to rerun the tactics of the tobacco industry. Between the 1960s and 1980s, that industry had spent millions of dollars to fund dissident scientists and think tanks willing to challenge scientific evidence about smoking's dangers. The document was an action plan drafted by the American Petroleum Institute's Global Climate Science Team that called for up to $7.9 million in spending to influence public opinion about Kyoto. It declared that victory will be achieved when average citizens understand, recognize, uncertainties in climate science. Recognition of uncertainties becomes part of the conventional wisdom. Media understands, recognizes, uncertainties in climate science. Media coverage reflects balance on climate science, and recognition of the validity of viewpoints challenging the current conventional wisdom. Those promoting the Kyoto Treaty on the basis of extant science appear to be out of touch with reality. The document also recommended that API identify, recruit, and train a team of scientists who do not have a long history of visibility and/or participation in the climate change debate, and fund them to add their voices to those recognized scientists who already are vocal. The New York Times obtained and published the memo before it could be acted upon, producing exactly the opposite public impact from that imagined by the memo's authors. This, increasingly, was the underlying structure of Washington policy debates, a kaleidoscope of overlapping and competing influence campaigns, some open, some conducted by front organizations, and some entirely clandestine. Strategists in the Kyoto campaigns created layers of disguise, subtlety, and subterfuge. Corporate-funded grassroots programs and purpose-built think tanks as fingerprint-free as possible. In such an opaque and untrustworthy atmosphere, the ultimate advantage lay with any lobbyist whose goal was to manufacture confusion and perpetual controversy. On climate, this happened to be the oil industry's position. Raymond's public affairs chief, Kenneth P. Cohen, directed a network of allies and grantees in Washington who essentially created chaos in the climate science debate. Walt Buchholz, like Cohen, a veteran of Exxon's chemical company, served as a policy advisor to the Heartland Institute, a Chicago-based free market group that frequently published tracts challenging the scientific basis for global warming fears. The Competitive Enterprise Institute on L Street received hundreds of thousands of dollars from Cohen's shop. Its free market advocates filed lawsuits challenging the implementation of climate reviews by the Clinton administration on the grounds that the scientific data relied upon was unreliable. Exxon provided $373,500 in 1998 and 1999 to the Annapolis Center for Science-Based Public Policy, a nonprofit that backed some of the most prominent scientists skeptical of mainstream science on climate. The center would eventually honor Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe, the Congress's most ardent doubter of global warming, for his work in promoting science-based public policy. The individuals writing and lobbying in the network Exxon funded described themselves as honest, libertarian skeptics who had the courage to challenge conventional scientific wisdom. They did not feel polluted by the receipt of Exxon money any more than liberal-minded campaigners might feel polluted by the receipt of grant funding from, say, the George Soros-backed, left-leaning philanthropy, the Open Society Institute. Relatively few of the thinkers in the network aligned with Exxon's views were climate scientists, however. They typically concentrated on economics and public policy matters. The books authored by members of this movement included titles such as Red Hot Lies, How Global Warming Alarmists Use Threats, Fraud, and Deception to Keep You Misinformed, and The Global Warming Deception, How a Secret Elite Plans to Bankrupt America and Steal Your Freedom. Inside ExxonMobil's K Street office, the sense among some staff was that a lot of this provocative activity was being stoked by the public affairs department in Irving with the idea that it would please the boss, Raymond, whose views on climate policy were well known. A few worried that the fringe campaigners might ultimately endanger shareholders by creating litigation or regulatory risk. The API internal documents rooted out by investigators for environmental groups did not contain the kind of smoking gun evidence about climate science that was earlier unearthed from the tobacco companies. The tobacco industry's documents made clear that corporate scientists knew that smoking was harmful, but nonetheless buried the facts and published misleading studies. In the case of the emerging controversies over climate science, there was no evidence that API or Exxon maliciously distorted in-house scientific research. The corporation's advocacy campaigners were now inching toward dangerous legal territory, but in the main, the action plan documented a subtle strategy involving the use of money to advance corporate interests by exploiting the uncertainties and argumentation that can be innate to science.